ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Is a cult a misunderstood religion or something more dangerous? Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on Radio National and ABC Listen and across the Pacific on ABC Radio, the panel show about the things we believe and why we believe them. And when we think of cults, we imagine perhaps long robes and Kool-Aid and maybe a bunker or two. But the line is blurry when it comes to religion, cult, and frankly, just plain old human behaviour that most of us find very unusual. Historically, the category you fall into has as much to do with timing, respectability, and who's doing the categorising as much as anything else. The focus should be on harm because we as humans seem to have an infinite imagination when it comes to new ways of doing bad things. But we also have an inbuilt fear of difference, which leads us to harm even when we think we're fighting it. With us is Sarah Steele from the Let's Talk About Sects podcast. That's Sect. Let's Talk About Sects. Great title. Also, Carol Cusack, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Sydney, and Scott Parker, writer, performer of Hillsong Boy, the stage show based on his life inside and outside the global Aussie Hillsong megachurch. And just to be crystal clear, we're not saying Hillsong is a cult, but we will talk about the intensity and spectacle that comes with living a life connected with such a youth-oriented, charismatic megachurch. And Scott, I can't wait to get your story, but first I just want to get an overview from Carol, because I've heard it said that everybody, to an extent, is a tiny bit cultish, and we all believe in conspiracy theories, even if it's just calling an honest referee biased when your team is playing. Is there something in that, do you think?
I certainly think so. The question, what is a cult and what is a religion, can be approached in so many different ways. I usually always begin by quoting Eileen Barker, who is now 87 and is one of the kind of grandmothers of the discipline of the study of new religious movements. And she says, a cult is a religion people don't like, and a religion is a cult people do like. But I think there's another way that we should start thinking about these sorts of things, and that's in terms of how much agency we want people to have. I am very aware that there are a lot of memoirs written by people who've been part of high-demand religions, small fringe groups, and they've suffered terribly. And of course, that's not something that anybody can write off or say is not important. And I think also there's an interesting difference there too between people who are born into a religious group and people who make a decision as an adult, and maybe they regret it later, but that's rather different to that situation being the only thing you've ever known in your life. So I think there's a lot of nuance in how we should approach, particularly legislative approaches to these sorts of groups.
And we'll get into that in detail, because the Victorian Parliament has voted to inquire into, for want of a better word, cults and high demand or fringe controlling coercive groups. Sarah Steele, welcome to you from the Let's Talk About Sects podcast. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I have a bit of a different view from Carol, although, you know, she did make some great points about the people coming out with a lot of harm. And I don't find that definition very compelling, because to me, when I'm looking at a cult for my podcast, and now I've been doing that for 7 years and speaking to those people who come out with all of that trauma, I'm talking about a specific group that is problematic and uses coercive control over its members. So I'm not talking about a religion that people don't like. If you look at coercive control and how it operates, you're looking at a dynamic that we now have started to recognise in abusive relationships, domestic abuse relationships, one-on-one relationships. And so you're seeing a pattern of behaviour that is definable. And so if you've got a group that uses those behaviours, I mean, I know we'll get into it later, but this Victorian inquiry, it's been very careful about the way that it has defined what it's looking into. And so it's not looking into the belief system. It's not about what you believe. You have freedom of religion, and I believe very strongly that you should have freedom of religion. It's about whether your organisation is using harmful techniques and coercive control. And so I speak about the domestic abuse relationship because you've got people who, when they come out of that relationship, that's when they can express that trauma. So if you're asking them when they're in that relationship, oh, how is that relationship? They'll say it's wonderful. And if you're speaking to the person who is the perpetrator of the coercion, they're going to say it's a great relationship as well. So to my mind, you really need to be talking to the people who've come out and what they're saying about that organisation after they've come out. You're talking to the survivors of those groups.
And the person, the victim on the inside who said it's going great, if it's not going great, they'll say, well, it's not going great, but that's my fault because I'm not doing it right. Scott Parker, is this something that may resonate with you? When you didn't feel happy and intact in your religious background, did you think it was something wrong with you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The way in which the theology is structured is that you do blame yourself for those kind of misbeliefs in some sense.
But you wouldn't call Hillsong a cult, even though you've written a stage show about your experiences in and out, good and bad.
I have many fights with my director about this because he believes it's a cult and I am on the fence about it. And I think mainly because the accusation allows Hillsong to sort of sidestep some of the issues that we're actually talking about. Instead of addressing it, they address the semantics of the word cult. And I just go, maybe the most important thing is to address the harm. And, you know, like you say, like not everyone is experiencing the same harm. So I'm a queer man. I mean, the show is about my queer experience within Hillsong. You know, it's one of the elements of that. Many people in the audience who come and talk to me afterwards also are queer folk who have experienced that sort of harm. I guess the hard thing is that there are many other very legitimate churches where that same harm is experienced by ex-members or members who are currently in the church as well.
And they wouldn't be cults either. This is interesting, Carol, isn't it? Is this why scholars of religion find this C word, cult, somewhat unhelpful?
Okay. Three things, I think this is unpacked, then they're really important. It's not true that everyone inside groups that sometimes use coercive control actually is suffering or having problems. Many people thrive. One of the things that I find totally amazing, because actually I'm not religious at all, but I go to an enormous number of conferences where legitimate academic papers are given about harm and damage caused by certain people. And usually there's a contingent of people from that particular religion attending the conference too. And I don't think they're all sort of Stepford wives in 21st century guys. I've met loads of well-balanced, happy, totally on the ball members of Scientology, the Unification Church, you know, various weird, what I consider to be kind of creepy movements that are guru-focused. And one of the issues that has to be acknowledged is that nearly all of these groups are actually good for some people. We might not like them to be, or we might think it would be easier to classify them if they were all harmful, but they're not.
That's a bitter pill to swallow. We want goodies and baddies.
It's easier to work with goodies and baddies. The second point I wanted to make was I don't think the word cult helps at all, and I know it's because of the pun. Sarah's program uses sect and sectarianism, which is recognizable even within the history of Christianity as being a way of cutting people off from other people so that you only encounter your own sectarians. I don't know, did everyone see in The Guardian the article about the Exclusive Brethren being about to open a supermarket that would not permit anyone who was not a member of the Exclusive Brethren to shop there or even to enter the building?
Fascinating.
That is sectarianism, very hardline sectarianism.
The Guardian also asked its readers years ago, when does a cult become a religion? And one reader said, when they go from killing believers to killing non-believers. Another one said, simply when the government gives them tax-free status. What, do you have a view, Sarah?
Look, it's to me, it's always about the coercive behaviours. And so I look at a lot of groups that don't even come from a religious background. So I'm looking at the same behaviours that happen in, for instance, a martial arts school, or Synanon was a drug rehabilitation program. And so it's about those coercive behaviours. And to me, you know, that's actually what makes it a cultic group.
Which drug rehabilitation?
Synanon. That was a really big one in America. It did actually become a religion in the end, which often does happen as well. They'll declare that, you know, they have access to a higher power. The leader needs to figure out another way to get more control over members. So that does happen quite often.
Well, recovering from drugs and alcohol is an interesting example, because a lot of people don't call AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and 12-step programs, it's not really called a cult per se, but people say, oh, that organisation is very cultish.
Yeah, and we see, you know, cultish, coercive control. It's something that humans, it's like a natural thing that happens in human behaviour. It's about the way that we relate to each other and wanting to kind of have some sort of control over our lives. And so it can be a fairly naturally occurring phenomenon, but it's something that we should be keeping an eye on and keeping in check. So, you know, when we look at this Victorian inquiry, for instance, they're looking at those behaviours. And so you may have a religion or another group that is exhibiting some of those behaviours, and there should be a great opportunity to actually educate them about actually why those are harmful behaviours, why they're resulting in people coming out with potentially with a lot of trauma, and they could put them in check. So I don't know, like, I guess when you're talking about a group like Scientology, I interviewed a former Scientologist recently for my podcast, and she was born into a family that taught her that her purpose in life was to be essentially an indentured servant for Scientology. Like, that was her entire upbringing. She wasn't given an education. You know, she lives in Australia. She experienced this in Australia and the UK and the USA. And I just think, I don't know, I'm not that interested in talking to the people who are having a good experience in a group that's doing that to people.
Mm. I was brought up Catholic, and I was born into a family that believed that everyone who wasn't a member of the Catholic Church and a faithful member at that would burn in hell for eternity. I personally think that is equally repugnant as a viewpoint.
I mean, equally repugnant, I suppose, but I guess the extra elements are kind of most people brought up into fairly mainstream Catholic faiths are able to have those relationships with people outside the group. They're not usually facing that same sort of like sectarian kind of the shunning when they come out. Like there's a bit less control over their lives than, you know, and I do understand, like, that is really obviously a hugely awful thing to have to deal with. But it's that question over the beliefs versus the behaviours and the coercion versus what you want to believe.
What do you think, Scott? I mean, we were talking AA, 12-step, that, you know, so-called cult saves lives. It doesn't ruin lives. And then we hear the Catholic Church in the old sectarian days, Carol's example, that can't be a cult, it's a mainstream church. But then it had intensely sectarian views. What about you and Hillsong? Is there good and bad at the same time?
I think, again, we're back to goodies and baddies, right? But, like, yes. I mean, I was kind of a bullied, small, isolated, arty, weird, queer kid. So I was about 13, and one of my friends at high school, one of my new high school friends, was like, hey, my dad's a pastor at Hillsong. And I was like, what's that? And he was like, oh, you know, we write a bunch of songs. And I was like, oh, actually, because I'd been to an Anglican church and I'd actually sung some Hillsong church songs there. And I was like, whoa, what? They write songs? That's amazing. And so he brought me along and I found, you know, like so many friends. It was just so different to anything I was experiencing at school or anything like that. A vulnerable kid. So, you know, finding that was like transformative for me.
Was it transformative not just in finding friends and community, but in finding God?
Yes, because it was all attached to that, right? Your participation within that community, it was dependent on your belief and progressing in that belief. And you didn't have to be like a saint, but you did have to, you know, have a relationship with God.
Looking back, was your relationship with God real or an illusion?
I would say, I was 100% genuine in my relationship by that. Like, I read my Bible every single night. I did street missions sometimes. Like, I went and talked to people on the street. That was not necessarily a Hillsong thing. I got involved with a whole bunch of other Christian organizations. And, like, you know, I really absorbed it. I'd spend hours writing worship songs. I mean, I learned guitar so that I could write worship songs for church. I was at church 4 or 5 days of the week sometimes. You know, it became all-consuming. You know, I was deeply committed. I would not have been doing that if I wasn't. Now, I think a lot of people at church look at me now and say, oh, well, you know, it mustn't have been genuine, you know, because he mustn't have been saved or whatever they think. But I disagree with that. I was so, so committed. I was one of the faithful, you know, and I have no qualms in saying that. I don't think I would have said that about myself back then. I think I was deeply full of self-loathing and definitely thought I could do better. But I look back now and I'm like, you know, I was devoted, like really devoted to Hillsong, to God, to my relationship with friends. You know, like devotion really sums up my 20 years of experience at Hillsong.
And now that's all renounced, or you retain some relationship with some kind of God?
I actually moved over to the Uniting Church and really kind of stripped back my belief. So basically, I had to renounce the doctrine of hell because the more I thought about it, the more I was like, no, I can't call this gospel. I can't call this good news. The idea that Nana, who didn't believe in God, now she's burning in hell, right? Like, that's not good news to me. That's awful. And I think a part of it was this sort of systematic deconstruction of these like tenets of faith. But when I got to the end of it all and I was like, what am I left with? You know, if I don't believe in, you know, substitutionary atonement through Jesus Christ, what do I believe in? How does that, what type of a Christian am I? I started rediscovering sort of the older traditions of Christianity, started, you know, hearing from the Catholic perspective or the Orthodox perspective. And that gave me a way to kind of take a more materialist approach or humanist approach to my faith, where I believe in God. I'm happy to sit in the mystery of whether God is this external force or rather the energy that flows between us in a conversation, the goodness between human beings, all of those things, justice. I am not interested in the question about whether there is a real God anymore, but I still want to practice faith. And I had to find an affirming community for that. I had to find a place that was happy with me being that weird form of Christian. I found that in a church like our Uniting Church, which is this wonderful affirming church in the inner west of Sydney. You know, they've been really happy to kind of have me there as this sort of weird Christian anomaly. And, you know, I think there are lots of people at the church who believe that sort of stuff. And I realized, actually, I don't have to be sectarian about my faith.
Well, that's great to hear you've come that way. And I'll tell you, Nana, when I see her in hell.
Yeah, I think I'll be able to tell it myself, to be honest.
On Radio National, this is God Forbid. I'm James Carlton. We are looking at, sects, new religious movements, mainstream religion, sectarianism, and the inherently difficult line we try to draw between them all. On Radio National Summer, this is God Forbid. And last year, 2025, the Victorian Parliament announced an inquiry into what it calls cults and organised fringe groups. State and territory governments are increasingly criminalising coercive control in marriage and de facto relationships. That's behaviour that may not be physically violent, but is still a form of domestic violence. And the Victorian Labor government says it wants to find out whether laws are needed to deal with organisations, religious and secular, that also harmfully and coercively manipulate and control. This parliamentary committee has been taking submissions and hearing testimony. It'll report back in September this year, 2026. Carol Cusack, is this a good idea?
I think I'm going to reveal something about my own perspective generally here. I find the way that our culture has become obsessed with securitization extremely disturbing. When I began as a student at the University of Sydney 45 years ago, It was possible at 3 a.m. to walk through the main quadrangle and find a goth rave happening. Nowadays, you can't go in there because there are enormous gates on every entrance. It used to be possible to walk into an interesting building on campus and think, this is by the architect X. I might want to go and look at it. Nowadays, you need a swipe card to get in. I have worked at the University of Sydney for 44 years, but my swipe card only gets me where I'm allowed to be. Now, I actually don't think this is a good idea. And I had a discussion with students yesterday about what St. Augustine of Hippo's idea, which is the idea of the summum bonum, the greatest good for the greatest number of people, might actually mean. And it used to be, well, if, you know, something fits the lives of 85% of people and 15% get left behind, well, you know, that's still overwhelming, isn't it? But of course, we've changed our view entirely on that. It's more difficult now when you have disability advocates saying, what right do you have to marginalise our lives and not give us the opportunity for good jobs or to be sexual people or to be in the media, to be actors and to be seen publicly? And so the point used to be, well, the disability community is tiny. We don't have to worry about them because the greatest good for the greatest number of people might pass them by. Where I would go with that is I don't actually think it's in the benefit of a majority of any society to live under heavy securitization. I actually believe in freedom and personal agency and personal responsibility, and I understand that there are cases where that is overridden, somebody's agency is taken away from them. Yes, I know that. But it's wrong to approach the whole question of organising a society as if abuse is the norm and flourishing is not. Because even if we don't all flourish, the more you say abuse is the norm, the more you will infect people with the idea that abuse is the norm and that flourishing is almost impossible. I already see that my students are infinitely less hopeful and have less agency than I had at 21.
Sarah Steele, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I also believe in freedom and personal responsibility. I guess I come at it from a different angle because my experience is largely talking to people who have been incredibly damaged by all of these types of groups. And so to me, I don't think it is normalising abuse. It's not saying that abuse is the norm. It's saying actually abuse isn't the norm. So how can we look at this and teach these groups that that actually is abusive so that they can stop doing those things? So I think the inquiry is a great opportunity for people to share their experiences, to make submissions, to kind of help the Victorian government inquiry understand what are the problematic behaviours and actually what can we do to curb them. Because when I'm thinking about freedom and personal responsibility, I'm thinking about the freedom of the people who talk to me and say they had no freedom in the group that they were a part of. And often, as Carol mentioned earlier, they didn't have personal responsibility in being there because they were born into these groups quite often. But the other side of personal responsibility is, like, people ask me all the time, like, why do people join these cults? Why are they joining? And it's like, nobody's joining a cult. They're joining a group that is a really welcoming, wonderful organisation. It's like they're love bombed when they go in. They find this amazing sense of community. It feels like a wonderful thing.
And again, like the domestic intimate partner relationship, no one says I've fallen in love with a wife beater.
Exactly. they get stuck in the abusive relationship, and that's what's happening in the groups that I'm looking at to a greater or larger extent. And to some people less, to some people more. Some groups are more harmful, some groups are less harmful. There's a lot of nuance in there. But is that a freedom of choice to join a group like that that turns out to be something that it really wasn't purporting to be on the outside?
But how does it get policed? Because this very parliamentary inquiry is saying, look, let's look at drawing the line between harmful and harmless. And one of the ways you can do that is look at the tactics to recruit new members. You mentioned love bombing, overwhelming new recruits with affection. Well, they do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. There's offering belonging and purpose. Well, what could be wrong with that when it's done right?
These are just recruitment methods, though. Like, this isn't really about the coercion.
True, true. Well, let's look at coercion then. Things like harming physically and financially. Well, if I take a religion might cause me to take a vow of poverty to help the poor. That's a good thing, and it hurts me financially. What about hurts me physically? There are religions which call on you to harm yourself, self-harm, to be closer to God. And if that's a free and open choice that I make, knowing all the...
That's the main point, right? Is that a free and open choice that you're making? And I suppose the way that I look at it is much more of a diagnostic rather than this is a cult. It's like, here is a list of the coercive behaviours that we see in these groups that people are coming out of with loads of PTSD, right? If you're ticking 8 of these boxes, there's a chance that you're looking at a cult.
True.
If you're ticking 3, there's a few behaviours you could look at. How could you improve? Like, why don't you take care of some of those? Why don't you become safer for people to worship in your group?
Interesting. Because one of the other boxes is you're asked for total obedience to a leader. Well, that could be joining a faction in the Labor or Liberal Party.
Sure.
But having said that, those factions don't ask you to whip yourself and take all your money. So maybe that's the way to find out the problem. Do you tick 6 or more boxes as opposed to just 1? What do you think, Scott?
I think these churches, they act with impunity because it's a totally opaque system. Nobody's looking. They feel like they are only responsible and they only answer to themselves. So I think they need to feel watched. That sounds really kind of the antithesis of what you were saying. But like, I feel that these churches, because they don't feel like they're being watched, they sort of just set their own parameters. And over time, that metastasizes, you know, it changes the nature of what the church is. Like, there are a lot of leaders at the church who totally were just operating at the same level that they operated for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, right? It never occurred the culture that they had set and that they were maintaining had changed. Because there was nobody to tell them. We used to, even at Hillsong, we talk about the revolving door phenomena. There were so many of my friends who were there for a year, 2 years, and then were gone. And we were always like, maybe we should do something about that. But nobody ever did. It was just numbers, you know? And had people talked to those people who were leaving, if they'd been like, why are you going? Maybe they would have identified these problems, kind of do something about it. But instead, there was no requirement for them to do that. You know, like, they are registered on the ACNC, they're a charity, there are things that they should be doing that for years they did not do. Now, they would argue that they did, and that's, you know, important to say, but there were things they weren't doing because there wasn't that oversight, because they were a religious body. Mm. And I think that providing that scrutiny, I think, is really important. They need to feel like they can't just...
And particularly with religious groups, you know, they really feel that they're answering to a higher power. So a lot of the time they're saying they're outside of the laws of the land, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
2 points. Demographically, there are different times in people's lives when they're likely to be more and less religious. The normal pattern is you might start your life off as non-religious, or you're a member of a religious family, but you don't kind of pay. You're a kid. Adolescence, which you pointed out as the time you joined, is a point of extreme intensity, and there's a lot of emotion, and people often become religious. They join groups. Usually the next step is either caused by career or marriage. If you marry within the religion, you're likely to stay because you'll want your kids to be brought up that way, etc. But if you marry out, or someone who's not kind of as interested, usually you'll discover that running a relationship and going to work and perhaps having kids, you drop off. You don't go so much, which is one of the reasons why the Catholic Church, for example, pushes so hard that parents have to actually go to church in order to enroll their children in schools, because it also boosts the numbers in the pews. Then people go through career and maybe they retire in their mid to late 60s, and usually if they're religiously inclined, they'll have a resurgence and it'll last towards death. So there's a life cycle of being religious. The other thing about the revolving door phenomenon, though, is it's like romances. Hillsong's a great example because, again, we've got reasonable stats on it, but Pentecostal churches in America work in the same way. 18 months to 3 years is the normal cycle of a person staying in a high demand religion, because usually it eats too much of your life. And the sociologists point out we don't actually want to make a commitment to play tennis every Thursday night or to play chess every Monday night or even to go to church. A lot of my Christian friends say they wake on Sunday and they think, I feel like a truck has driven over me. I'm not getting up to go to church. And they stay in bed. And I also think the fact that so many people come into Hillsong and leave it is actually a really positive aspect. I often say to my students, we should have a robust defence of Western values. My first robust defence of Western values is probably threefold. Everybody's worth the same as everybody else. You can have sex with whoever you like and no one can say anything about it. And if you want to, you can leave. If we don't all hold on to those three things, then we're not actually valorising anything that comes out of the Enlightenment.
Those three things, though, are the three things that do not exist in the groups that I'm looking at. Well, are three of the things that do not exist. The idea that we're equal to everyone else, like these groups teach that we are separate from everyone else and we are actually better than and above everyone else. Everyone else outside is not enlightened or does not have access to this greater information, whatever it is. The groups I look at, very commonly, you are absolutely not free to just have sex with whoever you like. No way. Absolutely not. And what was the last one?
That you can leave.
That you can leave. I mean, there are many, many reasons people feel trapped in these groups and don't leave for many years. And I've heard many of them. And so, you know, just going to church on a Sunday is incredibly different from the groups I look at as well. Like, they're demanding all of your spare time. That's one of the things that's a mark of a high demand group. And, you know, marrying outside of the group, most of the time that's not accepted. If your partner doesn't join the group, you're probably not going to be able to marry that person. And then the idea of leaving, like when you have children with someone in the group and staying, I don't know. Like I see a lot of people who leave because actually they don't want to bring up their children in the type of group that they've been in. Like they see that as really problematic. So that can be a big reason to leave.
And Scott, even this question of choice is fraught with difficulty, you know. Are you free to leave? Because we know that telling a battered wife, for example, and we're making the analogy between people who are in an intensive high-demand control religion with an abusive intimate relationship, if you tell a battered wife, why don't you just leave, that fundamentally misunderstands the complexity of domestic violence. Is it the same with religion, religious coercive control?
I think the idea that you can't leave, maybe there's a difference between those who stay the 16 to 18 months. You know, they stay there for 16 to 18 months, they move on. Ideally, from an internal people to become engaged participants in the congregation. But once you do that, your entire life gets wedded to the congregation. Your friends are the congregation, your week is scheduled around that. Even your career aspirations are sometimes embedded into the church, especially in a church that's winning Grammys. You know, I mean, I was on the worship team and like I had friends at the age of 16 who were receiving royalty packets for songs that they'd written. I remember I had like a influx of ads on MySpace because my friend was big in Brazil for guy that I just hang out with on the weekend. And so everybody worked out that I was in pictures with him and I ended up, and it was this little taste of fame. And I mean, everything is there. When I left that, I have to say I've had to kind of rebuild my friendships. I've had to rebuild a lot. It was real costly to leave. And it took me about 5 years from the first point where I started thinking, hey, maybe this isn't the type of environment that I want to be in all the time, or maybe this isn't good for my life. It took me, I was able to extricate myself because I kept going, well, if I leave, then, you know, like, where do I find places to sing? You know, like I used to say that my singing and my music, it was for God / Hillsong, you know. I didn't do it outside of that. I did not pursue a career in music, even though I love music. I left it for God because I wanted it to be this like sanctified thing that I had for him. And so this idea that I lose music, I lose my friends, I lose my community, like what do we even do? And I did meet my partner at Hillsong Church. So I was fully enmeshed in that congregation. And it slowly but surely, it became intolerable to me. Hmm. And slowly but surely, my beliefs changed. And then I was able to kind of extricate myself in sort of, I actually had a bit of a big moment where I sort of spat the dummy and walked out. But it took 5 years to get to that point. So it's not easy to just leave.
In the early 90s, I lived with a guy who was a computer programmer who worked for Cisco Systems. We had 4 years and 7 months together. And in the end, we broke up because there was no time actually to have a relationship. We, you know, we lived in the same house and all of that. But Cisco would put breakfast on for everybody, and everybody was in the office at 7 a.m. And people wouldn't leave the office for lunch because lunch would be ordered in. And I would I'd call, or I'd say, are you coming home tonight, or what are we going to do? And he'd say, oh, no, no, they've ordered pizza and we've got to keep working. And eventually, at the very end, I'd got quite disgruntled and said, look, I don't really think this should continue. And he said to me one day, I'm so tired. I don't want to invite people around. I don't want to have sex. I don't even want to have a conversation. I think probably I should move out. And he moved out and lived monastically on his own while giving those insane hours to the company. Now, that's only one industry. I have lawyer friends whose relationships have gone down the gurgler in exactly the same ways. We have so much difficulty in contemporary culture with the idea of any sort of freedom. The minute some organisation catches you, and I should talk, I've worked at the University of Sydney for 44 years, and, you know, I wouldn't recommend it really, not that enthusiastically. What do we do? I mean, this is what happens. The organisation clamps onto you and makes it very hard to leave. All your friends are at work. I was about to say earlier, Sarah was talking about PTSD. I mean, basically, if we had a sensible world, no one would be allowed to join the military.
Or police. I mean, what the things we do to our police in terms of inflicting PTSD on them and creating a culture where not only do we damage them, but we make them say, if you want to do something about it, you're weak. Toughen up. Is there something to be said here? I mean, is that almost cultish, Sarah?
I mean, I do think, yeah, if you look at the military and, you know, boot camp and the way that they operate, you could see some similarities to cultic groups. I suppose, you know, there are many reasons why you could differentiate those things, you know, working for a job and being aware of what that entails and the freedom to leave in terms of the ease of quitting. It should be much easier to get out of the military. Like, there are a lot of reasons why. But it's not to say that there aren't coercive behaviours across the board. Like, I've worked in companies that definitely had coercive behaviours going on, for sure. But to me, it's like, then if you can actually come up with some laws that recognise these coercive behaviours and you've got any organisation that can tick a couple of those boxes, that's a great opportunity for them to say, oh, maybe we should be doing something a little bit differently. And just in terms of your earlier question about leaving and what can be done, I mean, I think shunning is a really big one. If you're looking at, you know, what the organisation believes about shunning and maintaining proper, genuine friendships with people outside the group and people inside the group, not saying that those who leave are of the devil and we're not allowed to talk to them anymore and we totally malign them, like, that's one thing that we could look at. The other one is actually what happens on the other side when someone does leave a group like this. At the moment, we have no support services for any of these people. You've got people coming out who, depending on the level of severity of the control in the group, they might not know how to open a bank account.
Or catch a bus.
You know, like, they don't know how to operate in society. And there are no services for these people. Like, there's no societal support system to say, here's how you integrate into society. Like, here's a starter pack to get you going on how to connect with people and the services that are available to you and how do you, I don't know, get housing support, all of these things. And so even the groups that are perhaps not that severe in what's going on in the organisation, there's still a lot of support that people need when they come out of these groups. I mean, just psychologically, for instance, maybe giving them access to some psychological services. Like, the number of people I speak to who've gone to speak to a psychologist, A, either can't afford it, but B, can't find someone who understands what they've been through. It's, like, incredibly high.
Yeah. So I would agree. I've been to psychologists looking for people who understand the nature of 20 years in a place like Hillsong and what that does to somebody psychologically, to what it does to queer folk at, like, a psychosexual level. It's been very, very difficult to find people. And in fact, I've had psychologists say to me, look, I don't think I'm the best person to talk to. And that more than once has been said to me. So yeah, I would totally agree.
How did that make you feel?
Look, I guess the journey to finding the right psychologist is a long one for anybody who's pursued it. So anyway, so I think I just sort of took it on the chin and was like, okay, this is just part of what I would say to this day. I still really haven't found the right psychologist for what I need. Funnily enough, Hillsong Boy has been a fantastic sort of very public way of processing things. And I actually feel like somewhat healed by my experience of sort of being public about this, but that wasn't the purpose going into it at all. But I definitely feel like I should be doing it in private with a psychologist, but it's very hard to find.
It should either be really public or really private, or both at the same time.
Why don't we do both?
And just never in the middle. Like, anyway, on Radio National, this is God Forbid. I have a wonderful panel of guests, Sarah Steele, Carol Cusack and Scott Parker. We're talking about high demand organizations, coercive controlling religious groups, new religious movements, cults, whatever you want to call them. And up next, what emotional and cultural and social needs are being met when one joins and when one leaves. Do you know the word cult originally just meant worship, because it comes from the Latin, and I know Carol will correct me if I'm wrong, cultus, meaning care or cultivation. The word wasn't always pejorative. That's the point I'm making. Today it is this loaded term, and the weight makes all the difference when we talk about spiritual communities, high control organizations, power and harm. Carol, so these new religious movements and high demand organizations, it's said that in times of social stress and rapid change, that this is when they emerge. That should mean now, post-COVID, Trump era, we should be seeing it, you know, bloom, are we?
No, I don't think so. And I think obviously there are differences in different continents and different political systems, places with different historical religious inheritance. I actually think always there's an enormous number of small groups that are gathered around a charismatic individual. But I'm with the late Rodney Stark, the American sociologist, who pointed out that starting a religion's like starting a restaurant. Almost all of them fail. And this is true of just the charismatic group around a person. Very few of them survive the death of the founder. And even those that do survive the death of the founder, often there's a period of incredible kind of crisis and distress. And sometimes that group will collapse 10 or 15 years after the death of the founder, because no proper inheritance, no proper transition of power structure exists. So I'm not sure whether we have more or less new religions now than previously. I will actually finish with a point that Gordon Melton, another important sociologist of religion from America, now in his 80s, and who is himself a devout Christian and church member and always has been, he comments that the arising and emergence of new religious groups is a sign of a free and healthy society. And the only societies where it doesn't happen are those societies like North Korea and China, where in fact the government, state control, prevents such people from doing such things. And I think this is interesting because we do have a bit of a spiritual supermarket, commercial, economic metaphor thing going now for all of these things, and I just used the restaurant analogy that Stark came up with. People are entrepreneurial by nature and they're attracted to new things, and they also like trying different things.
What do you think about this, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to keep any kind of track of numbers of these things, you know. Like, I guess I have people approach me all the time now that I've been doing this project for a while, asking me if I've heard of this group or that group, and often I haven't. They think I know all of these groups, but it's impossible because for everyone that kind of finishes up, a new one pops out. So,
what needs do new religious movements meet that mainstream religion or secular society doesn't?
You know, I'm not really an expert on new religious movements. Like, I think, you know, Carol was talking about, she's really the expert here. It's good that more groups pop up. A lot of them are totally harmless. That's not the groups that I look at. You know, I'm looking at specifically harmful groups. So it's a different conversation, but they do feel, I would assume, they feel a similar need because people are joining these groups. I guess when I would put it in the context of upheaval in the world and the Trump and the COVID and all of these things, the thing that I would say is cultic groups are more likely to recruit people who are at vulnerable points in their life. So some people think they recruit vulnerable people. It's people who are at vulnerable points in their lives. And that could be, you know, university students are often targeted for recruitment by cults because that's a point in your life where you're kind of in transition and you're looking to dedicate your life to something. And so people who join a cultic group, they've just joined the wrong group. They just had a bit of bad luck in which charismatic leader they chose to follow. They could have chosen to follow a completely different one and it would have been harmless because many charismatic people are actually wonderful and doing good things in the world. So the upheaval is just creating more points of vulnerability in people's lives for them to accidentally end up in one of these groups.
So in our sort of world in which we want to protect everyone from everything, is the answer to outlaw vulnerability, outlaw life change? Or do we say, no, 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 you've got a choice, you're vulnerable and you're at campus, you can be an incel, you can be an addict of Apple products and live by their releases, you can be a Taylor Swift nut, you can be an anti-vaxxer, or you can have a almost religious intolerance of anyone who disagrees with your lockdown policy. The bad choices people can make in their lives are infinite. That's the byproduct of being alive.
Yeah, I guess I would say that what is a society if we're not working to protect the most vulnerable people within it, right? And what is a society if we're not working for greater equality at all times? So you're going to have fewer people at vulnerable points in their lives if you have greater equality. That's really what it comes down to, right? But it's the behaviours and the coercion that we should be looking at in a university context or a school context. We could be educating people about what those things to look out for are so that they're more aware when they find a problematic group, what they're looking out for. But we're also, again, which happens quite a lot, ignoring the experience of people who were born into these groups, who never chose to be there in the first place, who are children in these organisations. And if we're not protecting those children, what are we doing?
Two simple things. We could outlaw homeschooling. I know that would be very unpopular with quite a lot of people, but if you want kids to have a common education in which they all are exposed to pretty much the same information, homeschooling is normally done by people with fringe beliefs of some kind. So that's one thing you could do. And I think perhaps Sarah's earlier suggestion that there should be services available for people who require support, it reminds me of the policies not only of Gough Whitlam but even of Malcolm Fraser, the Liberal Prime Minister who followed him, in establishing the Multicultural Institute, which offered English language classes to people coming from the Indochinese War as refugees, that offered integration. We don't have anything that's anywhere near that holistic or extensive now in 2025 as there was in 1980, which is another sign of not looking after the most vulnerable people in our culture. So if we make everybody participate in a national curriculum, a national education, and we make everybody understand that there are supports for people who are for some reason excluded from the mainstream of our culture. And that includes migrant communities where people can't, for example, speak English, and so they can't even complain about what's happened to them because they just don't know how to. These are things I think that could happen. But the problem is we're in an era, neoliberalism is still very, very strong.
Well, final word from each of you, because as we become more secular and less involved in institutional religion or old-fashioned religion, I guess, do you think the problems we're talking about are going to fade away or are they here to stay? Sarah, you first.
Unfortunately, I think they're here to stay. I think that the dynamics of the types of groups that I look at, they're really human dynamics. And so that's why I think it is worth having some sort of system or way to reflect on what are those problematic behaviours. And I really look forward to hearing what's going to come out of this Victorian inquiry.
You think it is not beyond us to find a way to allow the freedom of the whole to explore life in all its magical ways while still orienting a society to protecting the individual.
I do, yeah, I do.
And Scott Parker, what are your thoughts?
I think that the nature of what we mean when we talk about cults and sex is sort of changing as well. I think the online space and influencer culture, if we're talking about charismatic gathering followers who then follow their every word, to me, I'm quite interested in that sort of new religion of that. It's certainly lots of my friends post Hillsong have kind of moved to follow online influencers in the Christian space. Some fine, some really not, with really problematic beliefs and behaviors. I think there's also, you know, things like Discord where these communities are now meeting online. So it's not just that are just talking to their followers are now talking back and they're, you know, enculturating each other. I think about the even like gym memberships, right? Like there's been an explosion in gym memberships over the last little while. And sometimes I look at my gym and I think we're a little bit of a cult. But thankfully, like, you know, we don't have the owner of the gym isn't like a guru. Coercive or a guru. But there are gyms that do have that kind of thing going on where fitness culture has sort of taken a turn there. I think the nature of what a cult is maybe is changing from maybe there are, you know, there's always going to be those kind of transcendental guru type cults. But I think the damage of these particular communities as well is one to kind of keep an eye on.
It's idolatry. What do you think, Carol Cusack? Final word?
I was thinking about Blaise Pascal. All those centuries ago, he said everyone had a God-shaped space inside of them. And it kind of depends what you fill it with, doesn't it? So a lot of people in religious studies like using the idea of the ultimate concern, something that the theologian Paul Ricoeur came up with. What's your ultimate concern? I often ask first years, is there anything you die for? One of the things that I find kind of distressing nowadays is most people say, no.
Well, at the beginning of the show, you said you weren't religious. Is there a God-shaped part or whole of you? And would you die for anything?
Yeah, of course.
To both?
I think that it all depends. We could shift the discourse. Let's just say there's a space inside all of us and it's got to be filled with something. And it used to be more likely to be God because religion used to be a lot more publicly and institutionally dominant. Now we might say meaning, which is where your comment about gyms fits in and things like that.
Purpose.
So let's say we've got a meaning and a purpose-shaped hole in us. Some people find it in politics, some people find it in their job, some people find it in their family or their friends, the people they love the most. I mean, most people I know would die for their partners, would die for their children, would die for their intimate friends. And I certainly would hope that I would put myself in that space. But I would also, I can understand dying for political principles. And I think in the pursuit of freedom and equality, we see people everywhere all over the world dying daily. And that's something that we should think about a lot here because we're tremendously fortunate not to have to.
Well, that is true. And on that important note, I want to thank our guests for being here for what has been a most informative program. Carol Cusack, Professor of Religion at the University of Sydney, thanks so much for returning to the program.
It's always a pleasure, James.
Scott Parker, thank you to you, the writer and star of the stage show Hillsong Boy, in production, yes?
To soon to be back on stage, so.
Should we visit the website for alerts?
Yeah, website, Instagram, just look us up. We're across most platforms.
Google Hillsong Boy. And Sarah Steele from the wonderful Let's Talk About Sects podcast. Thank you, Sarah.
My pleasure.
Sarah Steele, also the author of the book Do As I Say. If you or someone close to you has been affected by an extreme or controlling group, as we've been talking about, just Google Victorian Parliament Cult, for want of a better word. If you need support or help, you can always call Lifeline 13 11 14. You can follow and share the God Forbid podcast on ABC Listen. Find all the details about our guests and the show on the God Forbid webpage. Email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. Big thanks to producer Beck Kushwe. Technical production by Craig Tillmouth. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.